The Manitoba Chamber Orchestra's Vinyl Vault is Winnipeg's largest and cheapest record collection. From indie rock to funk, new wave to classical, there's something for every kind of music stomp. Records are $3 a pop, CDs even cheaper, and collectibles a specialty. Located in the basement of the Power Building at 428 Portage Avenue, Vinyl Vault is open 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on the last Saturday of every month. For more information about this monthly sale, or how to donate your used records to us, call 783-7377 or visit our website at themco.ca.
You're listening to At Large on 101.5 UMFM. Yeah, we opened the set with Steve Miller and the Joker. And, you know, as I said, I've heard this several times over the past couple of months, so I thought I got to play it. Huge hit back in 1973. Yeah, I can remember. It was on the radio all the time. Remember it well. And then it was new music from Jason Isbell. We heard Crimson Clay, and that was from his latest album, Foxes in the Snow, and that was released last year in 2025. And then it was the Montreal band, The Deers. We heard Lost in the Plot, and that was from their No Cities Left album. That was released way back in 2003. That was the Montreal band's second album. Then a live version of Frogs from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and that was off their Live God album, and that was just released last December in 2025. And then you just heard it there, finishing the set, Bryan Adams with Straight from the Heart. And that was from his Cuts Like a Knife album. And yeah, I was going to play Cuts Like a Knife, but I was thinking I was going to run out of time. I probably would have had time to play it, but I'm not going to play it, so that's why I played Straight from the Heart. So, yeah, thank you so much. I got one more song to do, but before I do that, I'm just going to say thank you so much for listening. The weather looks good for the next week, so enjoy it. A chance to get out. Not so cold. The sun's going to be shining. So, yeah, the show's called At Large. I'm here most Wednesdays from 4 until 5:30. Have a great week.
Tips his hat and walks towards the door. It's the second half of the cruise, and you know he hates to lose.
Hey, hey, Cripple Creek Ferry, butting through the overhanging trees. Make way for the Cripple Creek Ferry, the water's going down. A mighty tide squeeze. Hey, hey, Cripple Creek Ferry, butting through the overhanging trees. Make way for the Cripple Creek Ferry. The water's going down. It's a mighty tide squeeze.
Tanariwen are true originals with a sound that defies time or place. Their music may come out of the Sahara, but what they've built is bigger than geography. A mix of slow-burning desert blues and psychedelia built on repetition, space, and guitar lines that feel like they're always moving forward, even when nothing is rushed. It's hypnotic and mesmerizing with a kind of stillness and peace that washes over you. Touareg guitar masters Tanariwen perform at the Park Theatre for one night only on September 10th at 7 p.m. Great tickets are available now for only $45 plus fees, available via ticketweb.ca. Don't miss Tanariwen live at Park Theatre on September 10th, brought to you by your friends at Moto Live and proudly supported by UMFM 101.5. Trout Forest Music Festival's back and ready to light up Ear Falls, Ontario for another unforgettable weekend in the woods. From August 14th to 16th, Ear Falls Waterfront Park hosts 3 days of music and camping on the lake, 4 hours east of Winnipeg, but a world away from the everyday. Our lineup is stacked with a host of the most exciting voices in Canadian roots and folk, including the gritty, emotional depth of Juno Award winner Mariel Buckley and Moon River's lush indie folk. Son of Dave is sure to bring his signature raw, high-energy performance, while festival favorites the D-Rangers promise to showcase their classic country storytelling. With talent like Dom and Jacob, Raven Reed, Irvin Miller, and more rounding things out. It's a weekend that flows from the intimate to Full Tilt Festival energy. Tickets are on sale now at troutfest.com with early bird prices on weekend passes available until July 31st. Camping and RV passes are extra, but this amazing lineup of talents is a great value for all. Don't miss the 2026 Trout Forest Music Festival from August 14th to 16th in beautiful Ear Falls, Ontario. Proudly supported by 101.5 UMFM.
Good evening and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba.
Our guest this evening is Matis Grunsky, an artist and educator originally from Halifax, currently living in Winnipeg. He works with computer code and experimental electronics alongside painting, drawing, and plaster casting. Mattis studied painting and received a BFA from the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax and an MFA from Emily Carr University in BC. He currently teaches at the University of Manitoba and works with support from the Canada Council for the Arts. Mattis is interested in how we find meaning in chaotic information and how computational systems can be employed in material practice. Mattis has exhibited in various solo and group exhibitions, such as his collaborative show in 2021 with Emmy Sparks, entitled The Fine Line for Trap Projects in Vancouver, and the January 2025 collaboration Soft Paths at 226 Main Street in Winnipeg. His works have been reviewed in such publications as Border Crossings. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
You have an innovative practice working with computational systems, painting, and drawing. Would you like to share a few of your early memories of your interest in art and computer systems?
It's interesting because the idea of computer systems really didn't come to me until much, much later in my practice. But in retrospect, when I look at some of my earlier work, I can really see the thread of that systematic thinking existing. And so one of the artists that I was particularly interested in was Jerry Ferguson, who is an instructor at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, who used a practice of what's called frittage to take rubbings of objects in the world. And so he would collect bits of chain or industrial rebar and things like that, put them in piles, and then drape canvas over top and produce rubbings of them. And I found that really an interesting way of creating an image of something. And so without really thinking of it as a systematic process in that kind of formal sense, I was really interested in that way of working and followed that thread with some of my earlier work, which didn't use as direct a process as that. I used photos, and one of my earliest bodies of work was creating images of sidewalks and the bits of chewing gum that had been stuck on them as found compositions, right? Because sidewalks are these rectangles, and I was interested in just engaging with the world around me as compositional form. And so that's, for me, one of my earliest bodies of work.
Would you like to tell us perhaps about your formal studies at university and what you found most inspiring and valuable about these programs?
I'm laughing because I felt at the time actually really out of place. Every school has its own way of approaching certain media, and NASCAD at the time at least had a very observational grounding in painting and feeling more and more based in what you might call like a conceptual practice, I actually felt self-conscious about approaching those ideas at that particular place, at that particular time. And so I really value the classes and the ways of developing observational technique, but I felt like for my own practice, it didn't directly map onto what I was actually interested in. I think I should need to qualify that, though, where it absolutely had an impact on the way that I encountered the world around me. And at the time, I might not have seen that, but in retrospect, I really see how everything comes together and informs one's approach to things.
Did you find that the Emily Carr University was more in tune with your way of thinking?
Both yes and no. As a graduate student, direction of your work is as influenced by the institution and their ways of teaching. I did start to think more about the existence of systems and how to manage those in my practice, although I didn't make it to the idea of computational systems until after I left Emily Carr as a student. I did continue working there in a research lab under Amber Friede-Menes, who really exposed me to the ideas of computation and how that can be rolled into a material practice, which was really interesting.
Talking about exploring various computational systems and artists, were there any that you found were influential and informed your artistic practice?
It's an interesting question. And I think there are absolutely artists that I look at around those ideas, but I don't know if there's any in particular that I would cite in that way. I think it's important to mention certain artists that I reference or think about, one of which is Vera Molnar, who's an early pioneer of pen plotter use in art, and so using computational systems. And she actually started making work, I believe, before she had access to a computer, but using computational systems, and then was a very early adopter of these machines called pen plotters, which are essentially drawing robots controlled by code that were originally used, as I understand, for architectural drawings before there was the technology of inkjet printing. And so you would take a pen and put it in the machine and have it draw your plans for the architectural building or whatever. And of course, there's like an interest from an artist towards using a machine like that for making art. And so Vera Molnar, I believe, started work in the 50s and 60s, and probably later in the 60s or 70s got access to these pen plotters and started making work that way. Another artist that might be worth mentioning is Raphael Rosendahl, who's a web artist who actually started painting recently, which is kind of interesting. But I'm pretty interested in his approach to using the website as a place for an artwork. And there's many artists who explore this idea, but I feel like he has a particular approach to that that I find interesting and engaging, where when one makes a painting, there's a consideration of size and proportion and all these material considerations that go out the window when you start working on a computer in a browser, where you don't necessarily know what the proportions of someone's browser will be. And so there's some questions about how you can adapt the artwork to fit any potential size or any browser condition, which is a unique thing, but it opens up some really interesting possibilities with abstraction and with computational design.
Can you give an example of a web-based project that you may have done?
I have a couple veins of browser-based work. One of them involves the use of stereo images, but maybe I'll put that to the side for a second because that's a whole other can of worms. But I made a collaboration with my co-collaborator, Emmy Sparks, a couple years ago called To Do. It was a COVID project. And we found ourselves making all kinds of lists about things we'd like to do, things that we need to do. And we got the impression that a lot of other people were also making lists. And so we made this web-based project about list making that itself was a list. It existed as a folder system where you open a folder and there's a list inside that, and you open another folder and there's another list inside of that. And at the bottom of this folder structure, there's a couple different artworks that explore the idea of list making or things existing in sequence. And I felt like that was a unique format for an artwork. It could exist on a computer, but it could also be shared through the browser. And so that was a unique experience that I would like actually to continue exploring. It's funny when you have all these different threads of work and you go some distance on one and then you jump to another and you forget that one existed. So that's something I would like to revisit at some point.
Maybe you can tell us about some of your works that focus on building and programming of the computer-controlled drawing machines, the pen plotters that you speak of, and maybe walk us through your working process as you've built them and created your artworks.
Another COVID-era project where I found myself trapped in a room with an old inkjet printer that was broken and decided to take it apart and experiment with the parts that were inside and got really captivated with the idea of controlling a motor. And there's a couple of different ways you can do it. It's not really important for this conversation, but writing the code to understand how things move and how you can control the position of a pen, for instance, using those motors, really captivated my attention. And I never really had the intention of making a drawing machine so much as making something that failed. I didn't expect to succeed. But when I did, I had to take a step back and go, oh, wow, now I need to think about how to make an artwork with these things. Because there's something really captivating about the idea of using a computational system, using computer code, but not thinking of it in terms of a screen, not thinking of it in terms of pixels and RGB colors, but instead in terms of pens or charcoal or anything that you can strap onto the machine. And so I felt like the process of designing and programming and then iterating the design of these machines really influenced how I approached the production of the images that they ended up making, because I had this intimate understanding of the system and then made artistic choices based on that understanding. So it was an interesting way to get into working with pen plotters, and I've since used them for a variety of projects and come back to them every once in a while based on need. I've done a series of drawings of grassy fields and things like that. Use just one single line thickness of a pen to describe either a space or some kind of grid-derived space. I found them a little bit limited, though, because the way that I was approaching the structure of the image, it didn't have a whole lot of value or contrast shift. And so I started thinking more about developing hatch marks and gradients in relation to those things. But more recently, I've actually come back to working more with a linear form, and I actually produced two bodies of work just last year, or I guess 2 years ago now, having to do with the handmade gesture or the simulation of that gesture and iterative forms. And so those two bodies of work are a series of stereo cards, again, stereoscopic images, but presented in a 2-inch by 4-inch card form, and a body of flip books that are about 60 pages long and that have a looping animation that's formed with a looping itself line. And so I was really interested in the new possibilities that a pen plotter can offer in terms of the format of a printed artwork.
Is the element of chance and surprise important in your work? And can you give us an example or two?
Absolutely. Surprise or chance or happenstance, I think, is a really, really strong thread in my work that has always been there. For me, it derives a little bit from my own insecurities as an artist. At least as a teenager, I had this feeling like I didn't know anything. I didn't have this qualification to decide what was good and what was not. Or at least for myself, one of the things was always deciding if a painting was finished, or it felt like such a ridiculous choice to make. And so that's what pushed me to instead develop these kinds of systems of finding something that was already finished and just mapping it into my own work. So the sidewalk, for instance, became that found composition. And I've continued revisiting that form of the gum on the sidewalk, or various different iterations of that idea, as I've moved through my journey of working with computation. And so obviously in a computer, it's quite simple to randomly place something somewhere. I put random in scare quotes because it's not ever actually random in a computer, but for our visual purposes, it's random enough. And so it's one of these things in generative computational art. Randomness often gets used in place of data. You can either use the visualization of data or just replace the data with something random and get some interesting effects. But one of the key ideas is that you can have the same system and have it output different results based on providing it with different either information or different random seeds. And so when it comes to multiples, that's a really interesting idea where you have one system, one program, and can output an infinite number of prints or drawings or flipbooks or whatever from that single system, which is interesting. It brings up a lot of considerations of value when you have a system that can produce an essentially infinite number of copies that are each unique, how you value those things and what it means in terms of the particular composition, if you will, of that form. So those are still questions that I haven't really answered for myself, but they're quite interesting to ponder.
Can you tell us a little about your stereoscopic works?
Again, in retrospect, I had a lot of things going on emerging throughout COVID, but around that period, I came across a quite old book with a whole bunch of stereo photos in them. And it came with a little viewer, it had lenses, and you put the photos in and you see a three-dimensional depiction of a forest in Vienna or something from the 1850s. And I was really captivated by this idea that the stereo image has been around for a very long time. It's not new in the way that VR headsets are. It's a very old technology. And on top of that, I was really curious if I could write a program that would generate a stereo image. I'm also quite interested in perspective and perspective projection. And so it was a challenge for myself. Could I make a perspective image of something and then project it in stereo? And sure enough, it actually wasn't that challenging from a programming perspective. And so I started implementing it in many areas of my work because I felt like the stereo image had a really good resonance with computational thinking, where it captures this idea of repetition that the computational system gives you, but not perfect repetition. It's different two times. So with a rubber stamp, for instance, you can make many copies of the same thing, but they wouldn't be able to be stereo because it's the same thing. And so with this double stereo image, they're just slightly different, right? They're rendered from two slightly different points of view, and that allows you to see this three-dimensional image. And so for me, the stereo image really shows the capabilities or the underlying structure of the system that produces it.
Could you tell us about a few of the exhibitions that you've had your work in, maybe what pieces you've had and how you've selected them?
The selection of work is always challenging. I think maybe I'll speak about a show that I had just a couple of years ago at 226 Main Gallery on Main Street in Winnipeg with a fabulous friend of mine and artist Bramwell Enan. The show was called Soft Paths, and we decided we wanted to have a two-person show. And then the process of selecting each other's work and figuring out how the work would come together was really interesting. We didn't at the beginning think that we had a lot of, you know, our work is quite different in some ways. But the more that we sat down and looked at pieces, the more threads we were able to pull out. And I think we were put together a really interesting show in the end. So for every show, it's different, but that one was a particularly interesting one. And I'm actually of the mindset that I don't think it matters that much what work you have. It's about how it's put together in the space within certain constraints. I think it's really nice to leave things open-ended and not over-curate, if you will. I'll have all the curators mad at me.
What were you hoping your audience would walk away with from your show in general?
For me, in general, I see my work as something that I hope maybe primes the people that come in to take with them and then use as an experience to see the world again in a different way. So again, going back to those sidewalk paintings, it really derived from me having these, what I was describing as aesthetic experiences with the sidewalk, where I would be maybe daydreaming or just zoned out and all of a sudden realize I was looking at the sidewalk as a composition, as a painting. And I wanted to share that with other people. And so by bringing those compositions into the gallery, I was hoping to show everyone that, like, isn't this an interesting thing? And then hope that maybe they would go out and have that experience for themselves with something else in the world. And so I think for me, that thread gets pulled through all of my work, where there's a hope that I'm maybe sharing a certain way of looking at something with people, and then they might take that way of looking and extend it further for themselves, which is like a reductive approach to art, where maybe in the end, we don't need artists. Maybe everybody is an artist. And if everyone can do that, then we don't need artists anymore. But I'll leave that for now.
Have you done any artist residencies that have enhanced your practice? And would you like to share a little about those experiences?
Yeah, I've done a couple residencies. seems like I've been busy for a couple of years now. I haven't done any for a few years, but I did a residency in Victoria, BC for a couple of months. That was a very quiet experience. I found myself alone in the studio for long periods, and it was in November and December, so a very dark and rainy time in Victoria. And I felt like it gave me a really unique space to explore certain ideas. At the time, I was working a lot with synthesizers and audio, but also with plaster and some small sketching programs that I was making for myself. And the audio hasn't yet made it to any of my actual work. It's still in the background percolating. But what I found really interesting was I was experimenting with modular synthesis, which means that you can set up a patch and have it play itself independently for an extended period. And what I would do is set up these patches in the studio and then go and do some other work. And I really liked the back and forth between thinking about sound and having the sound exist in the space and then working with the other materials that I was working with. In the moment, there was a really clear impact that the two were having on each other. As I've moved further away from that, you forget what was going on and how it happened. But that's something that I would like to revisit at a future residency, because I don't necessarily have the capacity to do that in my own studio here in Winnipeg. But interesting. Every residency is different. Some of them give you that sense of seclusion, and others are much more of a social event. I did another residency in Finland almost 10 years ago, and that was less of a production event, but artistically, and more of a social connecting event, which was great. So I'm very open to any experiences at residencies. And sometimes they are more productive artistically and sometimes they're not. But it's always fantastic to see different places in the world and in different art galleries and museums. So for me, that's one of the main things I get, rather than putting pressure to produce work.
So you would recommend other artists look for those kind of residencies and experiences?
There's so many residencies, it's hard to say anything general about them. Some are more fantastic than others. Some put you in beautiful cities and have lots of resources, and others are a little bit more isolated. So it really depends on what the individual artist is looking for. And then there's always this thing about accessibility in terms of materials and tools and things like that. I found myself always needing to use the tools that I have at home in my own studio. And so whenever I go somewhere else on artistic residencies, I think like, oh, geez, why am I just not at home in my own studio? I have everything I need there. So sometimes it seems more valuable to put yourself in a self-imposed residency at home rather than going somewhere special, because I've put all this work into setting up my own situation here, and that it's hard to then leave that behind when I do have the time to work. And so that's one reason maybe that if you do find yourself in that kind of a situation, rather than putting so much weight on yourself to produce, looking for what is available and what is most value you can get while you're there in terms of, for me, it always comes down to seeing more work and just exposing yourself to as much culture as you can, because it does come back to influence your thoughts moving forward. So the work can always wait to be generated later.
Do you find travel and experiencing new cultures is important to your artistic practice and for fresh ideas?
Absolutely. Travel is nice. I find myself becoming more and more concerned about experiencing art exclusively through the computer, even if it's not computer art, browser art. So looking at paintings or drawings or whatever in its documentation form rather than actually seeing it in person is a huge difference. There's two sides to that, where it's not really feasible to expect to have to go everywhere to see the work. But when you do get that opportunity, it's extremely valuable. I've last couple of years been to New York a few times, and it's always amazing to go to the Met and the MoMA and the New Museum when it's open and all these fantastic collections. I do also really love going to commercial galleries, even though I'm not in the position to buy anything, but they often have extremely interesting curated shows, often showing work that would never be accessible in a big museum, maybe because it's too niche or too specific in some ways. And so I find myself very much drawn to the commercial galleries in big cities. Also recently had the chance of visiting Paris for the first time and going to all the commercial galleries there, as well as the big museums like the D'Orsay and so forth. But the big museums are a little bit overwhelming. You find yourself running through them, seeing all these massive historical artworks. Whereas when you go to the smaller commercial spaces, it's a bit more segmented, a bit more compartmentalized, where you might see some prints from Goya about some very small moment in time. And that has its own unique flavor and significance in your artistic reservoir of references.
You're also a professor at the University of Manitoba, as we mentioned. What courses are you teaching there, and what do you find most important about teaching?
I teach a variety of courses, most of them in the foundation year, the first year, so drawing, occasionally painting, as well as a couple of digital skills courses. There's a course called Digital Essentials that covers design fundamentals for the computer. And I've also developed a series of special topics classes centered around some of my own research interests, systems and sketching and creative coding. I also teach a class called Math and Art that explores the intersection of a very specific vein of mathematics dealing with compass and ruler constructions, visual proofs using geometry, which are fascinating, and then using those to think about how you can connect compositional ideas to some of these mathematical structures. In terms of how teaching affects my practice, I find it very energizing, just being able to talk to students about work that you like, slideshows, sharing and discussing ideas, but then also having the students bring their own things to class, bringing their own associations and their own work. And there's always these very meaningful discussions and conversations around art that you just don't have outside of art school. It's really challenging to find a place to have those conversations, however they come out. And so I really enjoy engaging with the students in that way. I should mention, though, I'm not actually a professor at the School of Art, but I am a sessional instructor.
So what advice would you offer young artists about choosing to become an artist?
Now, that's a tricky question. I think if anyone would like to be an artist, they should. Nothing should stop you from doing that. I think everyone can take their own path. And so there's no necessity to go to art school or get a degree to call yourself an artist. I think often there's a feeling among young people that they need to qualify themselves in some way to call themselves an artist. I know I felt that way when I was young, and looking back at maybe like high school, I really wish I took more science classes and math classes, because now those are things that I'm interested in. But instead, I took all this art. And so I think learning as broadly as possible is super important, rather than focusing in and saying, I'm an artist, I'm going to study art, because that only has value if you have other things to think about when you're working. So I'm catching up for myself on some of these things. I'm learning more about science and mathematics and history. All of those things come together and form some interesting conversations that can be had in the context of art. Also, that conversation can be had about skill. Skill really shouldn't be a consideration when you're making art. Obviously, you can work towards having certain skills and developing certain ways of working, but you sometimes hear these comments of like, well, I don't know how to paint. I don't know how to draw. I don't know how to do this. When in the end, it doesn't matter. You can make a drawing. You can make a painting without necessarily knowing exactly how something should or shouldn't be used, because those distinctions really are not very meaningful anymore in some ways. And so I think if you want to make art, you should go for it and don't feel too precious about whether or not it works or not.
What is next for you? You've mentioned a few things that you'd like to look into further. Are you working on any exhibitions or something particular you want to share with our audience?
For me, my priority is getting back into the studio as much as I can. I've been pretty occupied with teaching and a couple other research projects over the last couple of years. And I have all these dangling threads that I want to extend and turn into more substantial fabric in terms of my practice. And so I have all these things I've been wanting to do forever. And I just need to get into the studio and make it happen. And so whether it's building a new plotter for myself so I can have multiple going simultaneously, or finding a big slab of plasticine I can use for my plaster casting, there's all these things I need to get back into the studio and get busy with.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to share your interesting story and valuable insight with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here.
I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.
UMFM 101.5 broadcasts at 1200 watts from the University of Manitoba, located on Treaty 1 territory, the original lands of the Anishinaabeg, Nahiwak, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and the homeland of the Métis Nation.
We don't make a living on the farm. Dream.